waiting because he doesn't like to wait 5 minutes for anything. And he was sitting here all morose. His face was all drawn up in wrinkles.
But if we don't get the whole interview tonight, would it be all right if either, whichever is more convenient, either tomorrow morning or Monday on our way back from Sarasota, if we could stop by again?
What are you going to do in Sarasota?
We're going to talk to...
Where'd you come from just now?
Oh, we just came from White Springs. Oh. We drove all the way from White Springs. That's why it took so long.
Oh, I see.
How long does it take to get to Sarasota from
here? It's not far over the bridge.
About
a couple hours at the most.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, in case we don't get all
That's all right. Tomorrow morning would
anytime.
Be fine.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That'd be great. Because I know you're our prime candidates here. You're our stars.
Oh, dear. We're the stars. Did you hear her say that we're the stars?
Don't get all excited. Yeah, just
for
a little
show
here.
Oh, shoot.
Well, let's see. Are you ready to roll,
anytime.
Landon?
Anytime.
Okay. First, for the record, I wanted to ask first May and then Bob to tell me about your family and how you got started, as in early childhood with the medicine.
Well, the way I got started was in embryo. I was born in the business. My mother and father were vaudevillians. They started out as runaways, away from their homes, both in their teens. And my father left Durham, North Carolina. My grandfather was a railroad man, and they were very well established in the neighborhood and everything, and well thought of. And he disgraced the family by going into vaudeville. He became a ventriloquist, and he traveled with the vaudeville units. And then my mother was in New York City, and she learned to dance from a vaudeville team. And they were older than she was, so they almost the same as adopted her. They took her under their wing. And she had already shown a proficiency in music. She learned to play the piano quite young. And she could read the notes, and she could pick up any instrument, and you name it, wind instrument, percussion, or whatever. And in 30 minutes, with a sheet of piano music in front of her, she had it mastered. And then the two shows came together in Raynell, West Virginia. They had never seen each other before, and these two shows came together. And they were doing what we call in show business, bucking each other. In other words, day and dating. They were all in the same town at the same time. The town wasn't big enough to support them, so they had already been having some bad luck before, and the shows both folded. All of the show people were then stranded, except the ones that were provident enough to save in advance of a situation of this sort. And my mother and my father were two of the improvident ones who were left behind. And they were both staying in the same boarding house. And, of course, they had met each other. Show people have a tendency to intermingle when they run into another show. They all get acquainted, And while they were there, before the shows folded, she took a case of pneumonia. And she was upstairs in her bedroom. And when the show folded, she was sick. And my father stayed behind. Partly, he could have hitchhiked or something, got out of there. But he stayed behind on her account, and he was sitting on the front porch on a rocking chair, and a man came running down the street and shot a pistol in the air 3 times, and my dad ducked behind the chair because he thought the guy had gone insane. But that was the method of calling out the fire department. The hotel was on fire, and he ran upstairs and got my mother and saved her, and of course that made the romance, and they married. They married on very short notice. They'd only known each other like a couple of weeks. All right, then they decided they were going to walk across the United States on the cross ties, shipping their trunks ahead to the next location. This all is going in my book. And they shipped the trunks ahead, but the prime props that were essential to putting on the show, they found out between the two of them, they could present a show that lasted 3 or 4 hours because they were very versatile people. And he danced and sang. He did blackface. He did ventriloquism. He was also a wonderful lecturer. He could also do dramatic parts. And she was equally adept at dancing and straight parts and music and so forth. So They made a nice little show together. And she played, her specialty instrument was a Swiss concert zither. I don't know if you've ever seen one, but they have a fretboard. Then they have about 60-odd strings on the side, and she fretted the thing and played it, which is a rather tedious instrument to play. And so that being her prime prop, she strapped that on her back. And my dad's prime prop, of course, was the dummy, the ventriloquist figure. So he had him in a suitcase, and he strapped that on his back. And the two of them with their, and she had her clog shoes on her back, too. She danced the waltz clog. And so then they walked down the railroad tracks. And the way they advertised was they just told the guy at the station, well, tomorrow night we'll be, like, for instance, this is, say that's Palm Harbor down there, and this is Tarpon Springs up here, and they just finished at Tarpon Springs. They're walking down the track. They tell the man at the freight station, we're going down to Palm Harbor now, and we want our trunks down there. So they'd load them up, and the trunks would be sitting at the railroad station when they got there. And the guy in the station with this little, what do you call it, Morse code, tick-a-tack-a-tick-a-tack, you know, he'd say, watch down the railroad tracks. There's a young couple walking across the United States. They're going to put a show on at your place tonight. And the crowd would be standing on the railroad tracks waiting for them to help them carry the trunks to the hall and help them set things up and everything. Next morning, somebody was always there to help them put them back on the train and help them down to the next place. But they got as far as the far end of Kentucky, and they found out that she was pegadent. And I spoiled the whole trip. That's how I got in show business. That was a long story for just what you asked. And
Bob, how'd you start?
I was born and raised on a farm in Virginia, in the mountains, way back in the mountains. And the nearest place was 2 miles a store. And there was a little medicine show come to the place there, and I was helping them carry water and put up tents and stuff like that, helping them around there. And I thought I'd like something like that. You know, I never seen nothing really. You know, we was 8 miles from a town. We'd see a train maybe once every 2 or 3 years, something like that. And my mother died, and my father said it was all right, you know, to go with them. So I joined up, and I was 12 years old then. And there was a magician, a fellow that went with. And
it's a medicine show.
I told him, he won't know how much money I want. I said, I don't want no money, just show me how to make a living like you doing, that's all. In other words, he offered me money, and I wouldn't take it. I just wanted to learn. I'd do everything. I'd get up in the morning, I'd shine the cars and the old Model Ts, you know, and fix them, do whatever I could there to make people like you. I had sense enough then, just a kid, if people were like you, they'd do anything for you. So I learned to be a magician, and then he had a brother that was a juggler. He taught me how to juggle balls, clubs, knives, things like that. And then I was a blackface comedian.
Who showed you how to do black? The other brother,
no,
wasn't it?
No, Doc Edlin, The fellow I first went with, you know. So it was 4 years when I first, after I left before I come back home, you know. And I'd learned how to put on a show by myself. They thought that would be good. We were in the schoolhouse there, and he was going to let me put on the whole show.
Doc was very proud of what Bob had learned, and he wanted to let Bob show his family what he, you know, proud of him.
But my people thought I was under some kind of spell, could do all these things. They throw the darndest fit you ever seen in your life. There was something
wrong.
They were
going to put
anybody
him in reform
could do all
school
that.
Because he could earn his own living.
Yes, they couldn't figure that out at all. They thought it had some kind of spell over me, you know. And then when I was 15, I went out on my own and had one-man show.
What happened in that instance was Doc had, his wife had died, and he met another lady, and Bob was an encumbrance, so he gave him his walking papers.
So when I started out, though, I had my paraphernalia to work with, and I could put on a show for 2 hours and stay two or three nights in a place, and different and each night.
Change the program.
So, a long story, I don't know. So many things happen, there's no way to tell you, even to start.
What were you called back then?
Dakota Bob. I let my hair grow. I was a hippie, I guess, then. But I was passing off as an Indian. But then my hair got hurt curly. An Indian didn't have curly hair, and I had to cut that off. I didn't. So
all of this will be in the book that I'm writing right now. I'm writing the book about the medicine show, and it really is mostly autobiographical, because in order to tell it from our viewpoint, you know, and to tell the true experiences of what people like us had, you have to tell it from the inside, you know. And he and I met. My dad had the show in a little town in Virginia. Well, the first time we met, I don't know if you remember this, we were discussing this the other day, because we've been married 50 years last month, you know, and we were talking about the 50th anniversary and everything. And do you remember at Lexington, you and Carl came up to the truck, and Carl says, whose truck is this? And see, our outfit was just a little ricky-ticky outfit, you know. And what he saw on the road at that time was the old house car. But we had a what they called a sedan delivery, I guess, or a panel truck, or whatever you want to call it. They were both Model Ts, very modern cars. And the panel truck had cut up a dyno and wouldn't go anywhere but backwards. It couldn't go forwards. It was in reverse all right, but it wouldn't go forward. So my brother backed it all the way into the town of Lexington into a garage to get it fixed.
It's a Model T, and the bands would burn out on them awful easy.
So my dad and my brother were down at the garage with the truck. And these two guys walk up and want to know who owns this truck, you know. Well, show people are a little bit clannish, you know, and they always give all the information out, you know. So when he said, I said, it's my father's. And he says, are you show people? And I said, yes. He says, where is your father? And I looked at my stepmother, and she looked at me. We didn't know whether to tell or not, you know. We didn't have anything to hide, but we couldn't figure out what was going on. And so he said, well, we're show people, too, and we just wanted to talk to him a little bit about some of the towns that we're showing in, so we don't show in the same towns. I said, oh, all right, he's down at the garage, I suppose, with the truck. So they went down there. When we came back, the stepmother and I went down the street to buy shoes. I needed a pair of shoes. So we went down the street, and I found the shoes I needed, and we came back. And back then, you could buy a pair of shoes for $1.98, you know. And I mean leather shoes, good shoes. So we came back. I was tickled to death. I got my new shoes, and we came in the house car, and my dad and Bob and the old man that Bob had with him were standing over a road map picking the towns. Now, this is something the show people always used to do in the old days. Nowadays, it's dog eat dog. But back then, if somebody was in a territory and you ran up into that territory, you were man enough or decent enough. In the small time now, I'm not talking about the big circuses who used to paper over paper and all that sort of thing, but you'd say, now, where are you going to be next week? I don't want to get too close because I don't want to pull your crowd and I don't want you to pull mine. You know, it's common sense. Let's see where we're going to be. So he gave my dad a couple of towns that he had already worked that were good towns, good show towns. He says, if you go here, they spent good for me. I imagine they'll spend good for you. And it turned out that they were a couple of good towns. So we went. It was almost a month later. And I looked at him at the time, and I thought, gee, he's cute, you know. He's only about 2 years older than I was at the time. I was 17. And about a month later, my dad was sick. Was that Pamplin? I see this 50 years ago, and I'm confused.
Yeah, he was sick.
In Pamplin.
In Pamplin.
All right, so they came up over the railroad track with this car and trailer, and it had free show tonight printed on the side of it, and I said, "Hot dog, another show." And I had no idea it was the same people, you know. And I ran to my dad, and I said, "Daddy, there's a show coming over the railroad track." And he said, "That's all I need," you know. So they came on the lot and turned out to be Bob and Carl. And they wanted, Carl came again. He was the spokesman, even though Bob was the boss. See, Bob was a kid, but Carl was, you know, he had to be the boss. And so he wanted to know where Dad was. And I said, "He's in the house car. He's not feeling very good. He has bursitis." And so he went in, and he found out that Daddy was in a bad way, and Daddy did lectures and blackface and was practically the whole show, you know. So they said, "Well, we'll help you with the show this week." And they did. Bob did the black, and he broke me into two or three acts that I had never done before. And we put on a darn good show for the whole week. And Daddy was tickled to death because that was a week we would have lost. And at the end of the week, he proposed after the show one night, the last night. He came back there where I was packing up my bedroll and the tent and everything. I just kept barely enough to sleep for that night so we could get up in the morning. And he came around and he said, "We did pretty good this week. We worked pretty good together. We were a pretty good team." I said, "Yeah, it worked out real nice. I had a ball. I enjoyed every minute of it." He said, "Well, let's make it permanent." And I said, "Oh, isn't this awful sudden?" And it was, when you stop and think. We had known each other less than 10 days. No, less than 6 days at that time. So when my dad got up that next morning, I said, "I'd have to have some time to think about this, you know." And Bob says, "Well, how much time would it take?" And I said, "Well, I know a lot of people that have gone together for years before they decided to take that step." And he said, "Well, I couldn't wait for years. I'll give you 3 days." I said, "Gee, okay, I'll think about it, you know." And so my dad must have suspicioned something. He must have seen a little glimmer in his eye or something, or maybe in mine, I don't know. But anyway, he said, "I don't like that Carl, the old man." He says, "I just don't like him, so we're going to..." He had already told Bob and Carl that he was going over to this town over here, and I don't even know what town that was now. But anyway, after they drove off of the lot, he said, "We're going the other way." But he reckoned without them Model T tires. Before we got to Gladys, which is how far from Pamplin?
The 12 miles.
I didn't know it was that close. We had 18 flat tires. It was terrible. My poor little brother, I guess he just didn't fix the tires right. You know, I was 17, so he'd be 14. And he was the one that was fixing the tires. So anyway, didn't take Bob long to find us. He had a Studebaker that went 90 miles an hour, you know, and so he found us. And so to make a long story short, in about 3 or 4 nights, I'd see his car parked up the road when I was playing the ukulele. I knew it was his car. No other car in the area had headlights that widely spaced, you know, that far apart. And I knew it was him. So finally one night, I put the trunk out by the tree, and I put the ukuleles out by the tree, and a couple of blankets I had, and the flunky that was working for us was in on it. He caught on to what was going on and threatened to tell my dad if I didn't take him along for his bodyguard. "How do you know those two guys are not going to take you off somewhere and do something awful and throw you off in the woods somewhere?" Which is true, you know, and I got to thinking about that. And I said, "Lamb, maybe you better go back and get that trunk back." I had changed my mind. He went out there, and Bob had already got the trunk loaded in the car. I didn't have any choice. I had changed my mind. He had scared me, you know. He really gave me a scare. So, all right, we rode over rough roads and everything. We were married in Salem, Virginia, the next morning, September the 16th, 1931. It's a long time ago. And we've been holding hands ever since, so we don't slug each other.
Started with nothing. Now we got twice that much.
Yeah, right.
I think that's wonderful. That's wonderful, though. 50 years is, I think, anybody.
And we didn't have a party. Maybe I ought not to tell this part, but we're planning on pulling a surprise. You're not going to run this anytime soon, I hope. We're planning on pulling it as a surprise on the Christmas guests when they come, because this being a golden wedding anniversary, nobody can bring you gold. And I don't want bric-a-brac. You know, you can see why I don't want bric-a-brac. What I want is something that I can put in my scrapbook, something flat that I can make a special scrapbook for the 50th anniversary. So we're going to hand everybody a pen and a piece of paper when they walk in the door and say, all right, I want the anniversary card right now. And then let them write it on a piece of paper and fasten it in the scrapbook. That'd be the way to do it. I think that'd be the greatest thing. A whole lot nicer than a bought card, actually, because it would be something off your own hand.
What did your father do when he found out you were
I left a note. And not only did I leave a note, but I had cut that story short. What happened, I should tell you the rest of it. What happened was Bob sent a note, and he said he had been to the license bureau. I sent a note and said, don't you think you ought to get the license first? Because I was chilling on the DLC. And so he wrote a note and said he had already been to the license bureau, but the license would be no good until I signed it. And he sent the license with the note. And this was a clincher, see, that he was sincere. So when I hastily loaded my stuff to go out, I was going to pick that up last, and that I left on the couch, but not intentionally. You know, it was an accident on the folding cot that I had. And I also left a note that I wrote to my dad. I said, we're getting married, you know. And then two or three days later, I sent him a letter and copied word for word the marriage certificate, so that he'd know that I hadn't been kidnapped or that I hadn't done something real rash, you know, which I don't know, I guess it was kind of rash at 17, but anyway, when we got off that night, the flunky was a little bit off, two or three bubbles off, we'll say, and he knew where the car was. See, he went down, carried the notes back and forth, so he knew where Bob was parked, which was kind of an awkward place. There's two roads, one on each side of the railroad track. So he could have been almost anywhere, you know, and I wouldn't have found him with that limb on the job. So when we got ready to leave the lot, we used to have what they call pan torches. Do you know what a pan torch is? It's a gasoline. In our case, we used gasoline. It's a round, flat, looked like a frying pan or a banjo tin, and it contained gasoline. Then there was a pipe that strung down underneath it, and then off of that was a burner that made the lights for the show. Well, we had two of those hanging on the platform. Extremely dangerous. The gasoline was over top of the flame. And so when we were sneaking off down the lot, tiptoeing in the dark, Daddy hollered, Lem, when are you going to cut those lights out? And Lem says, right now. And he was right beside me. And I thought, Lord, if he looks out, he'll see us out here, you know, and he'll wonder what I'm doing out in the middle of the lot, you know, where I'm supposed to be in bed. So he ran up and he got up there and turned the lights out. And he says, now, Captain Jack, is there anything else you want me to do before I go to bed? Daddy said, no, go on to bed, Lem. So he came back. Now, I'm walking down a lot, but I'm on out in the little pea field that's just the other side of the lot line. And I didn't know it, but at the show lot, there was a little drainage ditch about big enough to pour a teacup in, you know. And as it went down towards the road to get the drainage, it got wider and deeper. And I was way down close to the road when Lem caught up with me on the wrong side of that ditch. And the weeds growing in the ditch and on the lot around it made it look like it was perfectly safe, you know. And he came running towards me, and he disappeared. He disappeared completely. And I said, oh, my God, you know. And I reached down to help him out of the ditch. I thought he was killed. And luckily it was a dry ditch. It hadn't been any rain. I lost my hat, a big picture hat, you know. I lost that down in there. That was something I used in the acts. And we scrambled around and found that. And I jerked away from him. I said, you make so much noise, you're going to give me away, you know. And I ran away and left him. And up on the edge of the road was a car with the door wide open, and I ran right up to it. And a drunk ass comes out, hello, honey, get in, you know. And Lem ran up behind me, grabbed me by the hand and says, that ain't the car, come on. And we came a-running, you know. Our feet just going plop, 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 plop on that pavement. I know that we woke up half the neighborhood. I don't know why Daddy didn't hear it. And Bob said we sounded like a couple of horses coming over the railroad track. We got in, and I got in the front seat with Bob and the old man, and Lem jumped in the back, and my little trunk and my bedroll and all my stuff was in the back, and he rode with his neck down and his feet up all the way to Salem that night. He was a character, but his intentions were good. He didn't want anything bad to happen to me, and I always appreciated that. You know, it was really cute. He was an old man, like in his 50s. It's old to us then, you know. Of course, nowadays, at our age, that's just a child, teenager.
That's wonderful. It sounds like it's kind of an adventurous story that everybody dreams of having.
Yeah, well,
and everything. But.
Well, now to go back to the performances, I'm doing a book on the... I was lucky enough, back in the 50s, to... have known an old man and an old lady that had what is known as a tab show. And in order for you, do you know what a tab show is? It could be done in a theater or it could be done on the canvas, and most of them were done on the canvas. And so the canvas and the tent and the word tab came to be more or less synonymous, you know, because they were almost always done on the canvas. The way they did those, they had like a three-act play that was actually a play, and it might be a farce, and usually was a farce. And at the beginning of the show, they would have a chorus line come on stage and dance and sing, you know, and then they'd dance off, and then the act would start. And then at the finish of the act, the chorus line would come on and dance and sing, do another number, and maybe they'd have... They could even have trapeze artists, or they could have jugglers, or ventriloquists, or anything in between. It was like a vaudeville thing. And then the chorus line would come on again, and they'd go into the second act, and so on and so on. They'd break the three acts up that way with entertainment. Because usually the three acts were comparatively short, and they usually wanted, when you paid an admission, they wanted a show to last at least an hour and a half, preferably an hour and three quarters to 2 hours. And that's the way they made it stretch, you know, they had the acts. Sometimes those acts could be deadly serious acts, but they still had that chorus line, come on, dance, and make it happy again, you know, and all that stuff. That's why they called it tab, because it was shortened version of a big, long play interspersed with entertainment. And so I met this man. His name is Bert Russell, an old man, and his wife's name was Bertie Russell. And they were real nice people. And he died. And I went to see her after he died because I heard she was selling a lot of the show equipment. And the one thing I was interested in was the scripts because I knew someday I was going to do what I'm doing now. I hoped someday I would do it. She had a stack, I'd say, almost 3 feet high of nothing but scripts, tab show, and vaudeville. And she wanted more money than I could afford. And I stood there and drooled over it, and I thought, God, I wish I had the money for that. And then I had an inspiration. I said, Bertie, would you care if I made a stack of the ones that I want and then have you price them to me? She said, no, go ahead, that's fine. So I pulled all the blackface stuff, which is what I was familiar with, and a lot of them were the acts that we had done when I was a kid. But they were their versions. And you see, these old acts were done in so many different versions that they were fantastic. You could do my version of the 3 o'clock train tonight, and 4 nights later somebody else do it, and they'd recognize the theme, but it would be so different they'd enjoy it all over again. And that's what made them so intriguing, you know. So I got a stack that just fills one of those tin file boxes. It's about almost a foot thick, you know. And... she made me a price I could swing, so I bought them. And they're brittle and crisp, you know, and but that's one of the rare times that they were ever put on paper. So what I'm doing now is I'm using those to make an auxiliary book to my medicine show book. Or if it looks like it's going to be too big a project, I might condense some of it and put them both in one. But some of the acts were really hilarious. Would it be a good idea for us to...
Yeah.
Maybe do a...
You just mentioned the 3 o'clock train.
Yeah.
Could you do the 3 o'clock
train? That was her husband, did the ghost.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was cute. And I found 2 photographs, and I'm going to give them to you if I can ever put my fingers on them again. Well, the 3 o'clock train...
That you can't do because it's visual.
Yeah, no, I meant her. You know...
Yeah.
Anyway, the 3 o'clock train is a farce, of course. Most of the acts that we put on were. And in this one, there are 2 versions that I know now because I got Burt Russell's version, which I love. I have never heard anybody do it except on that script, and we have done it a couple of times ourselves that way. The straight comes on in Burt Russell's, not the straight, but a straight comes on in Burt Russell's version and says, my older sister or brother, whoever's going to be the straight, wants to sell this property. This house has been in the family. The story goes something like this, whatever the person wants to say. This house has been in the family for 4 generations. It is in a dilapidated state. It was even used at one time as a railroad depot. It's in such terrible shape. But I feel that since I have children and she has none, that I should buy her interest in this house and keep it for posterity and maybe refurbish the house and live in it because I love the old home place. Now, in order to get this away from her, I've come up with a brilliant idea. I've told everybody in the neighborhood for the last 2 or 3 years that this place is haunted, and I've got the town believing it. And I made a bet with her. If she can stay in the house all night tonight and the ghosts don't bother her, then I will let her sell the house and take her half. But if she sees a ghost in this house tonight, then she's to sell me her interest in the house. She thinks she can get more money that way, but we're going to work it that way. And if she can't stay in the house, I get it. So I'm going to make...